For the week of January 17th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 38, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines in the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
In New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, hello there. I am Conan O'Brien, future answer to a $200 Jeopardy question.
Yes, I know. I'll have that one right.
Yeah, really?
Yes, that definitely is the news story of the week. And I don't know. I've been fascinated by it.
This story is so delicious, I can't get enough.
I didn't think anyone would top Leno stealing the Tonight Show away from Letterman, but this is even better.
And we're going to be talking a lot about this later on in the show with Dylan Stableford from TheWrap.com. We also have some guests on later in the show for our Inside Baseball segment. Guy Lodge from In Contention, Matthew Knott, who wrote an interesting column for IndieWire.com, and film critic for The Washington Post, Anne Hornaday. They're going to be on to discuss women in film a little later. But again, the story of the week has got to be Conan O'Brien versus Jay Leno versus NBC versus David Letterman versus Jimmy Kimmel. This whole late night talk show war has been fascinating. And frankly, I've finally started watching late night talk shows again.
So did I.
I never stopped.
I've never really liked Leno, but I've never really actively hated him. Now I actively hate him. I think what he did was, well, he just behaved so sneakily, and if that's a word, and he's behaving so smug now. You know, I feel for Conan, and I think he's handling it actually pretty well, all things considered.
Well, before we even get into that, we should probably talk about the box office, as we do every week at the opening of the show. We turn it over to Michael Giltz, who gives us all the numbers for this past weekend, at least in North America.
Absolutely. Another huge week for Avatar. It grossed $41 million. It's at $491 million total in the U.S., $1.3 billion worldwide. And ironically enough, it's finally starting to set some records. It had a slow opening week because of weather and a number of other factors, but now it's starting to set records. It's going to become the fastest film to reach $500 million in the U.S., beating The Dark Knight by about half. The Dark Knight took like 90 days, and this is going to do it in about 45 days. It's starting to set records for the biggest fourth week in release and biggest fifth week total weekend in release. So it's really starting to pile up. And of course, it's going to become the highest grossing film in the U.S. probably and worldwide of all time, because it's not even remotely slowing down, and it only needs a couple hundred million dollars more to top Titanic. It's obviously a remarkably successful film. Number two was The Book of Eli, which I saw, which grossed $31 million. Number three was The Lovely Bones, the poorly reviewed Peter Jackson film that DreamWorks actually managed to have a decent opening with. It grossed $17 million. Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Squeakquel, grossed $11 million, and it's at $192 million. Sherlock Holmes grossed $9 million. It's at $180 million. They're both going to become blockbusters. They're both going to reach $200 million, which I think is the new standard for a major Hollywood release. You got to gross at least $200 million. Jackie Chan had a kind of a sad opening for The Spy Next Door, a film which grossed $9.7 million. Meryl Streep's It's Complicated kept chugging along. It's at $7.6 million this weekend. It's grossed $88 million. Leap Year had a soft opening and not a bad hold. It grossed $5.8 million. It's at $17 million total. It didn't cost a lot to make, but it's not that breakout movie for Amy Adams. The Blind Side, starring Golden Globe winner Sandra Bullock, the biggest female star in the world, grossed another $5 million. It's at $226 million. George Clooney's Up in the Air is really losing steam. It only won one award at the Golden Globes, which was the Best Adapted Screenplay. It grossed $5 million. It's at $62 million total. It didn't cost a lot to make. It's a commercial success and certainly a critical success, but it's going to really need Oscars to get to the next level. And Daybreakers is fading fast. That's at $24 million total. Youth in Revolt is at $11 million total. That's the Michael Cera film. And we had a couple movies in limited release, like Crazy Heart, which is slowly expanding. Jeff Bridges just won Best Actor at the Golden Globes. The Last Station is the Helen Mirren film. And Nine, the musical, is basically dead. It didn't win anything at the Globes. It's at $18 million total, and it's basically done. What did you see this weekend, Karen?
I finally saw Avatar.
As I saw in your tweets, because I follow you on Twitter, shockingly enough, you were not excited by it.
You guys, this is the Emperor's New Clothes, okay? Avatar is nothing but a very expensive cartoon. This is not a good movie. It is not bringing anything new to the genre. People are just wowed by the fact that it's James Cameron and they have to wear 3D glasses.
Wait a second. What genre are you referring to?
Sorry, just movies in general. It's not bringing anything new to filmmaking.
You see, I'd have to disagree with you there. I mean, it's most certainly brought a wealth of technology, and it definitely advanced
the way cinema. It was filmed, technical level, the way it was filmed.
From a technical yes. level. Any other level, it has not advanced anything.
No, it's a bad movie.
And the 3D experience, I thought, frankly, was just average. What's really annoying is that, and this is also why I think people will not be really excited about 3D TV, is because you have to wear those glasses. And it instantly makes the experience very solitary, which is why it works in movies, because you're technically not supposed to lean over and talk to the person next to you. But I don't think it's going to work in TV, because there were a couple of moments in this movie where I would have leaned over and talked to my friend and, you know, made some snarky remark or something, but I couldn't. I felt weird. I felt like I was watching the movie in a box by myself.
Well, let me ask you this, Karen. How many 3D movies have you seen before seeing Avatar?
Maybe one.
How could you avoid all the 3D movies in the last 5 years?
Because they're all animated, and you know how much I hate cartoons.
There have been a lot of 3D movies, at least 20 or 30 of them. In the last
decade. No, much more than that.
But what does the fact that it's 3D have to do with anything? That's a technical thing.
It's like saying it's in color or black and white.
I'm talking about films as artistry.
What I'm saying is that the art form of 3D cinema was most certainly advanced by Avatar, and those who have seen numerous 3D films, most of them animated, will know that watching this film in live action it's definitely an advance of 3D technology.
Well,
who cares? That's an advance of 3D technology. Big whoop.
Yeah, I thought artistically Coraline and Up used 3D better than Avatar. I did appreciate the 3D more on a second viewing. I did find the detail and the sense of space a little more interesting, but it wasn't enough to overcome any of the story.
Well, now, of course, the big news with Avatar is, will it surpass Titanic as the highest grossing film of all time?
But again, you have to take into account that it was 3D and ticket prices are double.
The Hollywood Reporter says, in fact, industryites now say it's not impossible that Avatar can beat the $1.84 billion worldwide cumulative gross for Cameron's Titanic, a record that stood since 1998 and has been considered a bridge too far.
Yeah, this was an item I highlighted. It appeared before this weekend's box office grosses, but even before this weekend grosses, I mean, it's ridiculous. Not impossible. It looked, you know, as I say, increasingly likely, and now it's really a given. It will definitely be the top grossing film in the U.S. of all time. It only needs another $100 million as of the end of the day today, because it will gross $500 million any minute now, and it's almost certainly going to become the biggest grossing film worldwide. It's just inevitable now.
It's made $100 million on IMAX screens alone, and each day when I check the box office, I am just amazed at how much money this film is making on weekdays. It's making $8, $9, $10 million on a Tuesday. That's amazing. And of course, last night, it won the Golden Globe for Best Picture and Best Director, which we'll be talking about in a second, I guess. I completely forgot to mention that when we opened the show.
You know what really struck me about the fact that Avatar won was the fact that Cameron mentioned Kathryn Bigelow, as he does in almost every interview.
Well, I guess we're talking about the Globes now, aren't we?
Well, Karen, you weren't impressed by Avatar. Were you impressed by Ricky Gervais and his performance as the host of the Golden Globes last night?
I thought he did adequate. I would have liked to have seen him done something a little more out there. You know, I would have liked to have seen him take some chances. What did you think?
I thought he was sort of predictably cheeky. It was sort of just a little rote. You know, it's like, oh, he's tweaking them. And it just felt a little flat. I'm a big fan of Ricky Gervais. And he wasn't bad by any stretch of the imagination. It just was sort of, okay, yeah, he's making jokes about the people, you know.
The best line he had in his monologue there was, by far, looking at all the faces here reminds me of some of the great work that's been done this year by cosmetic surgeons.
See, I don't find that really very funny. I thought that seemed kind of tired. I thought it was a lot funnier when he did things like whip out the DVD of his, you know, his movie coming out and talking about The Office, and he had that behind, you know, the podium too. I thought that kind of stuff was funny.
Yeah, I mean, he was constantly plugging his own work, which when he was on Conan this past week, he gets on and he says, look, I don't know when they're going to cancel right. you. So right off the bat, I'm just going to plug everything
That's
that
funny.
I've got right now.
Because they might end the show in the middle in any minute now, yeah.
Right, exactly. So he just like literally rambled off all of the things he's doing.
Did you listen to the end of the show? Great. He said, I'd like to wish for world peace Or, no, strike that. I'd like everyone to watch my show on HBO, which debuted.
That's funny.
February 19th.
Yeah, that was – he had his a few moments. But overall, it was sort of the tired, he's controversial. He's making fun of, you know, Paul McCartney getting a divorce. It just felt a little
by the way, what in the world was Paul McCartney doing there? And
he had a song nominated for Best Song. He wrote a song.
I thought he was
going
to die. And I thought Harrison Ford was about to die, too. When did he get so old?
Oh, see, I thought the women looked worse. I thought all the plastic surgery on high-definition plasma TV, it was scary. It is really a really sad epidemic to see Nicole Kidman and all these actresses having their faces pulled and their forehead can't move. It's really upsetting, I find. I really find it upsetting and sad.
No, I agree with you, except I thought Meryl Streep looked beautiful.
She looked good, and you could see wrinkles around next to her eyes because she's
and
a normal human being. Yeah.
Okay, well, now we should go over some of the winners.
Well, the biggest winner was NBC because it jumped up a little bit in the ratings. Last year, it reached 15 million viewers, and this year it reached 16.9 million viewers, almost 17 million, which is definitely a big jump from 2 years ago when they had the writer's strike. But it's still not as good as it was in 2007 when the Globes drew 20 million viewers. But NBC is in such bad shape that it's the best performance in young demos since the ER finale, which is really a comment on NBC as much as the Globes. But I bet, Sperlin, you were going to talk about the actual awards themselves.
I'm sorry, there were awards? For what?
There were awards for top box office performances because The Hangover won Best Comedy, and that's the top grossing comedy of the year. Avatar won Best Drama, and that was the top grossing drama of the year. James Cameron won Best Director because he directed the top grossing film of the year. Sandra Bullock was Best Actress Drama because she starred in the massive hit The Blind Side. And Robert Downey Jr. won Best Actor Comedy because he was in the massive hit Sherlock
Holmes.
What
did you think of his acceptance speech?
It was one of the best of the night.
Yeah, I agree. It was funny. It was smart. It was very Robert Downey Jr. It was clever. It was thought out, but it felt loosey-goosey. It was very good. It won't get him an Oscar win, but it will maybe get him a nomination.
And to explain to listeners, what he did was he got up and basically said, look, you know, I'd like to thank my wife, who told me that I would not be winning this award and didn't need to prepare a speech. And so therefore, I'm not going to thank her, and I'm not going to thank Warner Brothers because they needed me, because we were going up against Avatar.
But then he started going off into, like, thanking people by saying, I'm not going to thank, and then it starts getting exactly sort of loosey-goosey and like, well, is he being sarcastic? Does he think he's being funny? I'm sort of bored with this speech.
Oh, no, I thought he was totally – it was just an intentional, I'm not going to thank, and then he thanked everybody by saying he wouldn't thank them. It was, you know.
Sort of stupid, I thought. I liked Jeff Bridges' speech, and I love Meryl Streep's.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep. Jeff Bridges won Best Actor Drama for Crazy Heart, and Meryl Streep, of course, won for Julie and Julia. I shouldn't say of course, because she was also up for It's Complicated, but she did one for playing Julia Childs. And gave a nice gracious speech, as she always does. And, of course, our supporting actor and actress were, as always, Christoph Waltz and Monique. They're definitely locks for the Oscars. You can lay your money down now.
I thought Christoph Waltz's speech was fantastic. And it really tied together thanking everybody by telling a little story. And they were trying to shoo him off the stage. And I thought that was just completely disrespectful.
Well, it's like, oh, I don't recognize you. Off you go.
Yeah, pretty much.
Exactly. The nice thing was that it's clearly designed specifically for the Golden Globes, so he'll have a different speech for the Oscars. So he showed both he can give a good speech and that he's not going to repeat himself. Because sometimes people give the same speech at every award show and you get a little bored of it. And this matters because people voting for the Oscars sometimes will get really moved by a speech and like a person more or want to hear them say it on the Oscars. Or if a person gives a really ungracious speech, like I think Mickey Rourke had a bad speech at the Globes. And that can hurt your chances to win an Oscar. So it really matters. And Monique gave a very nice heartfelt speech. And then the last awards were Best TV Drama, Mad Men, and Best TV Comedy, Glee, which I was also happy to see.
But Glee doesn't deserve it yet. I'm not saying it's not a good show, but it's...
Compared
it's been
to
on
what?
For what, like 12 episodes or something?
Compared to 30 Rock, compared to... I mean, it's better than most other comedies on TV. Even with its flaws, it's a lot more interesting and fun. I would happily vote for it.
Yeah. I just don't think maybe next year. I was also sort of disappointed to see Mad Men win again, even though I love Mad Men.
Who deserves it more in comedy?
I could have seen Modern Family take this, and which, of course, the same argument would hold true. It's too early. But no, I think you're right. I think the other three were sort of tired, too. And as much as I love How I Met Your Mother, it's really not Golden Globe worthy.
There's a phrase you don't hear very much.
I know, right? Who are these people? There's like 12 members of the foreign press who like don't write very much, and somehow we give them all this power.
I know. I'm from Bermuda. I wish I could get part of the Golden Globes.
You know, I was really glad to see Juliana Margulies win for The Good Wife.
Yeah, I was too. You know, because it could have been the same old, that, you know, I really like it when they recognize new stuff. When it's a fresh new show like Lee, I hate it when they wait 3-4 years before they're like, okay, now you earn it. And so she's really good in that show.
And the show's already peaked at that point, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not a great show, The Good Wife, but she's a terrific actress and she's good in it.
Yeah, and, you know, again, I guess it sort of goes back to what I said. I can't like the fact that she won and Glee's props, I know.
Jane Lynch, I was sorry she didn't win. She certainly was great. I like Chloe Sevigny, and she's good on Big Love, and she hadn't won yet. But I was really thought Jane Lynch would be in lock. Did you see Chloe Sevigny's name? They changed her name spelling.
They spelled her name wrong.
Did she change the way her name is spelled?
No, that was a screw up on the part of whoever's in charge of the Chirons.
I thought maybe there was some new. She said, "No, you know what? I'm sick of that E. I want to be Chloe."
Yep. They misspelled her name. I noticed that too. It was the first thing I noticed. I'm like, proofreader.
Well, they also mispronounced Michael Haneke's name.
Yes.
And for foreign language film, he won best foreign language film for The White Ribbon, and they called him Michael Haneke.
Oh.
Boy, did I want a prophet to win.
Yeah, that would have been nice. The French film, which we saw in Cannes.
So, Sperling, did you think James Cameron's speech helped him or hurt him for the Oscars?
I don't necessarily know. I was surprised that he mentioned his wife, Catherine.
No, the Na'vi, speaking in Na'vi and then trying to be modest and failing miserably. As he said, I've made a film that can waken us up to the preciousness of our planet.
Yeah, well, the whole Na'vi thing.
That was awesome.
It's like not even a real language, okay, guy? Get over your own film.
No, it is a real language. We've talked about this. He hired a linguist who created a language. It is indeed a real language.
When he got up there at the end, when it won best drama.
God help us.
And he said, some of you I've known and I have worked with. Some of you, I thought he was going to go on to say, some of you I have known and have slept with.
That would have been funny. I mean, that would have been much better than what he said.
How many ex-wives were in the audience?
I think just two, unless Linda Hamilton was there.
Yeah, really.
I just want to know who actually is the technical director of the Golden Globes, because how awful was the directing? At one point, they actually cut to a camera that was like swish panning across the...
Oh my God, I was getting seasick.
It was...
Yeah, they had really bad live editing this year, really bad live cuts. I mean, it's always casual and they always try to catch people in unscripted moments when they're not, you know, politely watching. They like that. I think that's their thing, but it was pretty sloppy.
Well, and if you show Kate Winslet, is it a rule on award shows that you then immediately have to show Leonardo DiCaprio? Even if you happen to be saying Jeff Bridges' name? Because that happens all the time.
I think that might be a rule.
You know, and what is going on between Jennifer Aniston and Gerard Butler? I know they're supposed to be dating, but are they still together? Because they look like they were going to kill one another.
They're supposed to be dating?
I guess that's a sign that they're not dating anymore.
Man, she looked like she was going to kill him.
She always looks like she's going to kill somebody. She really is just upset because her career has been killed and because the bounty hunter looks awful.
Drew Barrymore, speaking of people who looked awful, what was the deal with that dress? She had like a live animal on her shoulder.
Yeah. That was unfortunate.
I mean, as soon as she got up, I was like, really? Nobody told you to look in the mirror. Nobody said, hey, I don't think you should wear that dress.
Yeah, it was unfortunate.
Well, and when they were, you know, whoever was directing this thing, when Michael Haneke, the Austrian filmmaker, Austrian-Czech filmmaker, who won for The White Ribbon, Best Foreign Language Film, they cut to Arnold Schwarzenegger because he's Austrian, I suppose? It's like, are you really?
I imagine he would have been proud of his fellow countrymen winning the award. Why not?
I don't think they know one another, but still.
And I don't think Jennifer Aniston's career is over because she's been in a surprising number of commercial hits, though she's never really gotten a lot of traction or credit for them. And she's got like 5 movies in the hopper, so she'll be fine.
And can somebody please explain to Meryl Streep that when you were nominated for 2 awards in the same category, your chances of winning are pretty good. So you should probably
prepare. No, they're worse.
No, they're worse.
Yeah, no, you often cannibalize yourself. They know different people support different roles and then someone else wins. So it does not help yourself at all.
I mean, she just seems so surprised. I can't believe
it. Oh, that's her acting.
She's surprised every time she gets up on stage.
Right. But she has not won many awards. To be fair, you know, she's been nominated a gazillion times. She does not win. She says, everyone thinks I have a show full of awards. I don't. Give me more.
Well, wait a second. She just set the record for most Golden Globe wins with 7.
Golden Globes. Who counts? I'm sorry. Yeah, we're talking about the Golden Globes. Who cares? She's just practicing her performance. This is a dress rehearsal for the Oscars. That's all the Globes is. It's a walkthrough. It's a read-through.
I have to say that I was very happy to see that Michael Giacchino, who is a music composer and composed the music for Up and The Incredibles and Ratatouille and Lost, the television show, and who I used to work with in the Disney office back in New York in the early and mid-90s, won the award for best score. I was very happy.
Yeah, it was for Up, the Pixar film, and it was wildly deserved. It's a terrific score. It's sort of a pastiche of classic film scores from different eras, and it's great, and it's really well deserved, and I hope he wins the Oscar too.
Yeah, I think he will. I think this is his year. And, you know, I'll tell you, he always said, oh, I want to be a composer, and I want to compose films. And, you know, I was going to NYU at the time, and he showed me this, he had rescored the 1933 version of King Kong. And he wanted to score this film I had made, this student film. It was a silent film. And his stuff was all on synthesizer. And so I was like, well, I mean, he's good, but I'd rather have an orchestra record it. And he understood that. And of course, he works now with full orchestras. He's credited with bringing the full orchestra back to television. And so I went off and recorded my score with a composer named Alan Williams. And of course, Michael Giacchino went off and decided to become a Golden Globe winning musical composer.
Yeah, Michael Giacchino also did the score for Star Trek, which was great. The finale of Lost, Star Trek, and Up. It's a pretty good 10, 12 months.
That's true. Well, I just learned one thing last night watching the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I have to start growing my beard. Because apparently, if you're out of work, or you're an actor, or you're a big name in Hollywood, you got to have some form of facial hair. Ricky Gervais, Tobey Maguire, John Hamm, they all had beards.
Well, maybe Conan will start growing a beard.
Yeah, but Sperling, if you grow out your beard, it makes it look like you're looking for a gig.
Good point. Speaking of people who are looking for gigs, I know a couple people in Hollywood who are looking for gigs now. It seems like last week was the week where nobody could keep their jobs or wanted to keep their jobs. Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire, Kirsten Dunst, all out of Spider-Man 4, and the studio is now pushing the film from summer 2011 to summer 2012.
This is insane. This is literally an idiotic move. Tobey Maguire is almost past the age where he can play Spider-Man. Sam Raimi has given them a $4 to $5 billion franchise delivered every time. They fought with him on the last film about the movie he made. They didn't let him make the movie he wanted to. It got poor reviews and still made a ton of money. Why would you not let them make, after three films so wildly successful, why would you not let them make the movie they want to make? Even if it's a disaster, it's going to make $600 million. And you can always reboot with a young guy. But this is practically your last chance where you can work with Tobey Maguire. Why would you do that? It's idiotic. It is throwing money away. It is incredibly stupid. And I can't believe they're not being pilloried more by the industry for a moronic deal. Yeah, Sam Raimi and Tobey Maguire have been sort of gracious, but it is completely idiotic. They're throwing money away.
Well, here's what Sam Raimi had to say. He said, quote, working on the Spider-Man movies was the experience of a lifetime for me. While we were looking forward to doing a fourth one together, the studio and Marvel have a unique opportunity to take the franchise in a new direction, and I know they will do a terrific job.
Right, and that's bull, because it's not a unique opportunity. You can always take it in a new direction once you've run your course with the current people. Why would you not let them make the movie they want to make?
Because Tobey Maguire comes into the life is too short category as an actor.
I don't know what you mean.
He's so difficult to work with that it's not worth it.
Oh, please. It's worth it. They made $4 to $5 billion.
They don't need Tobey Maguire to have a successful Spider-Man.
Oh, hello, Superman Returns. It's always a danger when you put a new actor in the franchise. It's not a given. You've got the director and the star that are identified with the franchise and have made you billions of dollars. Sony is literally throwing away $1 billion.
I think that if they put in the right actor, and I believe they've chosen the director already.
It right? doesn't mean it won't work when they reboot it. It just means you're throwing away a guaranteed $1 billion from theatrical and DVD, easily $1 billion safe, no matter how bad it is.
And Karen, you were just mentioning that they picked the director. I think there's some rumors about Mark Webb, the director of 500 Days of Summer, being on being on the top of the list, but I don't think they've actually picked him yet. That would seem like an awfully strange
choice. Tobey Maguire said on the red carpet last night that he was fairly certain that the director had been picked, and it probably is Mark Webb.
Well, then if it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt to play Spidey, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But you see, but that's my point. You know, there are other actors out there
who do not come on the
Life is Too Short category who could make Spider-Man, you know, equally interesting.
Absolutely. But while you've got Toby and you've got Sam Raimi and they're making films that are incredibly wildly successful, to throw away $1 billion on a possibility of somebody else working out is stupid.
Yeah, but knowing the way that Tobey Maguire negotiates, he probably asked for that $1 billion up front.
Historically, if you look back, the Batman franchise, started by Tim Burton in 1989, did reboot with a couple of different actors, George Clooney and Val Kilmer among them. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see whether Sony can do the same thing with Spider-Man. Certainly one studio that has to be kind of snickering in the corner is Disney, which now owns Marvel, which has the rights to Spider-Man.
Well, but they're not.
They don't get they have no say over this movie.
Yeah, why would they snicker? They're not gaining a franchise.
No, I think they're hoping that, the whole thing falls apart and that they eventually.
Won't. They'll make a movie and it could work great. It does nothing to do with the fact that they're throwing away $1 billion.
Well, speaking of throwing away money, we should probably talk about Conan O'Brien, Jay Leno, and NBC. Not necessarily in that order.
I think necessarily in that order.
Yeah.
Of course. What we're talking about is the big news of the week, and that is one that everyone seems to have an opinion about, which is the feud between the Tonight Show host Conan O'Brien, NBC, and the former Tonight Show host Jay Leno. Now, we have a lot of listeners from outside the United States in countries such as Russia and Australia and the Netherlands, so for those who don't know, Conan O'Brien and Jay Leno host late-night talk shows here in the United States, and to explain what has happened with their shows recently, here is another late-night talk show host who has scuffled with NBC in the past, David Letterman.
And then what happened? We came over here to CBS.
Yes.
Jay, Big Jaw Leno, had the Tonight Show.
Big Jaw.
And then he went on to do very well with the show, the Tonight Show.
Oh, yeah.
And then Conan O'Brien, a nice fellow, took our old job. We were here. So now Conan O'Brien was on at 12:30. And about 4 years ago, he said, I want Jay, Big Jaw Leno's job. Mm-hmm. And they said, NBC, the people at NBC, and I want to tell you something, a lot of people criticize these executives at NBC, but don't kid yourselves. If they didn't know what they're doing, they wouldn't be there. So they said, sure, Conan, you can have The Tonight Show in 2009. Was that what they said he could have it?
Yes, it was.
And so they went to Jay Big Jaw Leno, and they said, Jay, we're taking your show away from you.
Yes.
And Jay said, yeah, okay, that's pretty good. Right. I was going to suggest that.
Right.
Jay now decides he wants to go on at 10 p.m. They said, fantastic. And he did a wonderful variety show on
big
at 10
variety
p.m.
Show
big there, variety yeah. show mm-hmm. on at 10 p.m. there at NBC.
Yeah.
And one thing leads to another, and it didn't quite work out the way the geniuses in programming thought it might work out. So now they pull the plug on Jay. They pull the plug on him, and they said, okay, your show is canceled. You're going back to 11:30, and Conan's going to 12:05 to do The Tonight Show, which, as somebody pointed out, really, at 12:05 is no longer The Tonight Show.
No.
It's tomorrow's show.
It's the tomorrow, really.
It's the next day's show. So now everybody says, what will Conan do? Will Conan stay and do The Tonight Show at 12:05? And then Jimmy Fallon gets pushed back to, when does he start? He would start then at 1.
Yeah, he would.
And then at 2. The other guy,
Carson Daly,
show would have started at 2. Yeah. And I called NBC and they said, well, we've never heard of Carson Daly. So there. And as nice a guy as Conan is, he's a smart fellow, and he knows that if he takes a hike, he's going to lose an enormous sum of money. Mm. So he just now says, well, I'm not going to follow Jay.
Right.
You guys do something about it. So now NBC has to do something about it, and they have to do one of two things. They have to either pay him an enormous sum of money. I mean, how much money do you think we're talking about, Paul?
$40 million.
Just about in that neighborhood, my friend. Just about in that neighborhood. And that's big dough. So now the last thing they want to do, they just want Conan to quit and go away and do a show in his basement. That's right. What they want. That's exactly what they want. But he's a smart kid. He's not going to do that. He's in there for the cash, or they waive his non-compete clause so he can go to Fox or come here and take my job.
Joining us now by phone from New York City is Dylan Stableford. Most recently, he served as senior editor, digital, at Folio Magazine. He was formerly the managing editor at MediaBistro.com, an editor at MTV.com, and served briefly as an associate producer of The Howard Stern Show on E! He writes regularly about music and culture for several publications, including Rolling Stone, New York, and Salon. And he writes a regular blog for TheWrap.com. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So it seems, according to Sharon Waxman over at The Wrap, that it's over. NBC is going to pay Conan O'Brien $30 million to walk away from The Tonight Show after 7 months.
That's what we're hearing. The story, though, you know, it's changing almost by the minute. But at this point, it appears that he is going to take that deal and walk away, leaving NBC with, you know, the show that they had promised him.
Well, now, the latest I heard from Michael Giltz, I might add, is that he's going to be walking away this Friday. He's going to announce it tonight. Is that correct?
As far as I know, yeah. I mean, we're sort of waiting. NBC has said that they're going to announce something, most likely this afternoon.
So where do you think he'll go? Fox?
You know, that's the obvious thing that since this whole entire fiasco started, that's been the talk, because they're the one, you know, major network without a late night host currently, and they've been for years have been searching for one. In fact, this whole episode was sort of played out once before when Leno had first taken the Tonight Show job in the early 90s, and Fox was at that point was a player, as was ABC. So yeah, I mean, that is definitely a spot for him. I've heard a lot of people who are sort of on this quote unquote Team Conan sort of, you know, internet movement. They want him to go to be like the first late night host to go, you know, internet only. But to this point, I don't know if he's ready to take that drastic a leap.
I think I'd rather make money.
I think I'd rather have viewers.
Dylan, to me, right. The biggest surprise is the way the other late night hosts have suddenly started weighing in a really pointed way. I mean, of course, it's a source of humor, but it really feels like Letterman and Kimmel and the people are piling on Leno and really just vilifying him, which surprises me to a degree.
Which is actually what you wrote in on The Wrap on your blog this week. You had a post called "The Vilification of Leno: Loud, Nasty, and Fleeting." So you don't think that Leno is this backlash against Leno is going to last?
Not in terms of viewers. I think Leno's viewership, you know, sort of is when he left, a lot broader viewership in terms of demographically than Conan, which is sort of one of the problems that Conan was having. Although there's a lot. I just don't think Conan was given enough time. But in terms of the vilification, yes, I think when Leno first took the Tonight Show job, he was sort of vilified then for taking it away from David Letterman, in a sense. Even though justly or unjustly vilified, I think at that point it was more of NBC's fumbling of that, and there were a lot of people actually who were in support of giving Leno the Tonight Show slot over David Letterman. But the vilification sort of, it was fleeting then, and I think it will be this time around. The only difference, I would say, is this, in 92 or 93, when that happened, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, there was no sort of social media to sort of kick this idea of Leno as a bad guy even further. So I think it might take a bit longer this time around, but I do think eventually his viewership will forgive him.
Well, you say here, with news cycles now sped up to ridiculous proportions, the bet is that Leno's role in Late Night Crisis 2010 will soon be forgotten. Indeed, Letterman's sextortion scandal now seems like it happened years ago.
That's the other side of the coin is that with the news cycle sped up, people do have, they're sort of like closers in baseball. You know, they got to forget what happened the day before and sort of move on. And I think that there is an element to that here as well.
Yeah, but Leno is no Mariano Rivera. Anyway, this has been a huge fracas. It's not just fun gossip. It really has had major implications financially for NBC. The Daily Beast had an item that estimated it might have cost them over $200 million, but with paying Conan O'Brien off, building the studio they did for him, lost affiliate revenue and ad time revenue. They had stripping Leno at 10 p.m. That's hurt their local news stations. That's hurt the lead into the Tonight Show. Jeff Zucker's been damaged. I wonder, Dylan, what you think the biggest mistake was. Is it kicking Conan out before he has a chance to succeed, especially when he's had a weak lead-in and been able to reach young people? Was it stripping Jay Leno at 10 p.m.? Or, in my opinion, was it the decision to force Leno to retire 10, 20 years before he would have been ready to, when he was still in his prime and making NBC a ton of money?
Yeah, you know, I think all of the above. I don't think there's. I think NBC has made a ton of mistakes. I think at some, you know, there'll be college courses at some point. You know, looking at this as a case study and how to screw up something that was. I mean, Leno was number one, forcing him to, like you said, retire the Tonight Show banner. Whether that was probably. Simply, in a simple way of looking at it, like that was mistake number one. Mistake number two was essentially promising that sort of this whole really slow motion passing of the baton, and then 7 months later, after you know everybody's sort of getting used to the idea of Conan as a host of the Tonight Show, then. To just sort of pull the rug out. I think that, you know, it's also a huge mistake. You're right. I mean, it's the fodder of late night jokes. It's hard. I mean, you know, given the subject matter, it's hard not to laugh at some of these mistakes, but it is costing, a real frightening amount of money to NBC. So I just wonder, as Comcast, which has an agreement to buy NBC Universal. I wonder what effect this entire saga will have on that deal, if and when it does, you know, pass through, federal regulators finally sign off on it, which, you know, may or may not happen. What will NBC, the NBC that they agreed to buy, what will it look like?
Well, Kim Masters, in her column on The Daily Beast, says CEO Jeff Zucker has been mercilessly mocked, even in Maureen Dowd's column, with Universal chief Ron Meyer emerging as the hero in the saga, and Jeff Gaspin having proved that he is capable of running those profitable NBC Universal cable channels very handily. The question asked, and asked, and asked again, is what purpose Zucker serves. Even if they weren't already planning to be rid of Zucker, what can the owners in waiting at Comcast make of him now? So I guess the thinking there was, even though he's just signed a 3-year contract extension, that Jeff Zucker may not have a long life at NBC, and that Jeff Gaspin has really stepped to the plate here. Certainly Ron Meyer is coming off to be the hero. Apparently he was the person as, I think he's chairman of NBC Universal. He stepped up and got all the parties in a room and helped negotiate this deal for Conan to leave, presumably with a huge payday.
Well, I want to know, how much of a hit does Leno take in terms of people liking him? I mean, he looks pretty bad in this.
Yeah, that's another question. I think it's going to be hard to judge a bit because, you know, before he left the Tonight Show to move to 10 p.m. And hand the baton to Conan, the ratings were down and were going down, and then when, as it's been pointed out many times before, I mean, one of the biggest problems is so when NBC moved Leno to 10 p.m. they immediately were going to take Conan was going to the ratings for Conan were going to be down significantly because they didn't have a strong lead in of people in Iowa watching a cop drama. So moving him back and then having these new perhaps new shows, it's going to be hard. The ratings are probably not going to be what they were even when he left. So that's sort of going to be hard to judge. I mean, you can easily say, well, we'll look at how many, you know, viewers he lost throughout this whole thing. But it's a big chunk of it's going to have to do with that lead-in audience.
Certainly, we'll wait to hear what NBC has to say later this afternoon, and it's a story that, at least for the next week, will be playing out. Even Arnold Schwarzenegger last night on the Golden Globes made a comment about NBC. It seems to be the butt of more than a few jokes on the Golden Globes. It's definitely something that everyone that I speak with has an opinion about, and right now it doesn't seem like, at least the people I'm speaking with, nobody seems to like Leno in all of this. He definitely is coming out.
But the people you spoke to never did like him.
That's where I was headed with that statement. That's very true. I think, you know, in time, it will probably pass. I don't know whether he'll ever.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he'll ever achieve the ratings he once had. Letterman certainly is the winner in all of this. And if you ask, I think it was Joe Flint in the Los Angeles Times, he's saying in the end, Jimmy Fallon may be the winner because he somehow inherits the on-deck circle for The Tonight Show by being the current host of Late Night.
Not a chance.
And I think that would be, unless he really improves quite drastically, I can't see that at all. But, you know, I didn't think Conan would work either. So go figure.
Sure.
Well, Dylan, I'm speaking for all of us here. Thank you for joining us to discuss the whole NBC debacle. And you can be followed on Twitter at Stableford, and I'll spell that STABLEFORD. Of course, your column is on therap.com. We'll place links to all of this in the show notes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me.
Well, that was good of Dylan to talk to us about the Tonight Show fracas. It is kind of fascinating. I mean, Jay Leno at one point in the 90s was hiding in a closet to try and listen in on negotiations to find out if he would get the Tonight Show. He stole it away from David Letterman, who Johnny Carson had sort of anointed his heir. He became the host of the Tonight Show. He was incredibly successful. And then they forced him to retire when he still had a good 10 to 20 years left in him. And they forced him to retire. And that was the big mistake. And they pushed him out. And now 7 months later, he's going to be right back in again. It's an unbelievable, you know, tale. It really is just amazing. He's launched on Letterman. Letterman helps make his career. Carson helps give him a great slot. He steals the show from Letterman. He's there. He's massively successful. He's kicked out by the network because they're worried about their number two guy. And now he's back in charge again. And I think the lesson is, you know, don't worry about your number two guy when you've got a number one guy. You know, they were worried about Conan going somewhere else and doing well when they had the number one show in late night. It was hugely profitable, hugely successful. Their guy wasn't even close to ready to retire, and NBC was stupid. This was the only mistake. Everything else follows from this. Asking him to retire when he was so in his prime commercially was an incredibly dumb idea, and they were just wimping out because they were worried about the number two guy, Conan O'Brien.
But they would have no way of knowing 5 years ago when they promised Conan the Tonight Show that Jay Leno would be in his prime. And frankly, I think that's when you do retire, when you're in your prime.
No, Carson waited about 15 years after his prime. Your late night hosts, it's familiar. It's just a comforting blanket. You're there for decades. Carson was there for decades. Leno could easily have been there for another 20 years. There was no reason to ask him, all right, 5 years from now, we want you to retire. They weren't anticipating he would slip. They were just worried about Conan.
Right, but in order to keep the number two guy 5 years ago, they told Conan that he could have the Tonight Show.
Yes, but you don't worry about the number two guy. If you've got the number one guy, you don't worry about the number two guy.
But whoever the number one guy was 5 years ago, you don't know if he's going to be the number one guy in 5 years.
You have no reason to think Conan would suddenly do better than Leno. Leno was an institution. He's incredibly commercially successful. He never had the critical hosannas of Letterman or Conan. That's true. He wasn't cool. He just made them a ton of money, and he was by far number one in the ratings. He was kicking Letterman's ass, and there was no reason. NBC didn't have a crystal ball. They didn't think, you know, I bet 5 years from now, Leno will be slipping. It'll be time for Conan. They were just worried about Conan going somewhere else.
But Jay Leno agreed to this. He said, I will step down in 2010.
He didn't want to. They forced him to.
So what? He still agreed to it. Now he's a big baby, and he's like, I want my show back.
Well, he's not a baby. NBC needs to do – NBC's got a disaster on its hands, and he's the proven guy in late night.
Well, here's how Seth Meyer on Saturday Night Live's Weekend Update described the whole situation.
Let's say you're married, and it's the number one marriage in the country. But then you meet someone else who just sweeps you off your feet. So you say to her, I want to marry you in 5 years. And she says, yes, I will wait 5 years to marry you. So then you go home and you tell your current wife, honey, in 5 years, we're getting a divorce. Now, you might think your current wife would be super cool with that and say thank you for being honest. But it turns out she's actually super mad. And as the 5 years pass, she gets in really good shape. So when the time comes for the divorce, she's looking better than ever. She looks so good that you see other people looking at her and you get jealous. So you come up with an awesome plan. You'll still marry the second person, but you'll also stay married to the first. So you tell the new wife, good news, we're totally married, but every night when I get home, I'm going to spend a half an hour with my first wife first, but then I'm all yours. And before you even see how she feels about it, you hold a big press conference and tell people that you've changed the future of marriage. Now, if you think the new wife is cool with this plan, she's not. She's super mad. And the first wife is also acting weird because, you know, you have two wives. But then, just when you think you're stuck, you come up with a perfect plan to solve all your problems. You kill your second wife.
Well, see, that's a good point. You don't say 5 years from now, I'm going to divorce you. You see what it's like then. Everything's going well. You don't say, you know what, 5 years from now, let's call it quits. They should have waited till they got there. And Conan should have known not to trust NBC. Look what they did to his TV show. He and Andy Richter created a sitcom called Andy Barker PI, which is really sweet, got great reviews, and was quite commercial. You know, it's an accessible, easy show about an accountant who becomes a private eye. And NBC treated it like dirt. It got great reviews, and they literally dumped it in the worst time slots. They moved – it was only 6 episodes. They moved it around. They treated it with such disdain, and Conan should have said, you know what? These are not admirable people. These are not honorable people. I delivered a TV show. You'd think they'd want to keep me happy. They're treating this like dirt. What does that say about NBC? I need to watch my back.
Well, you know what? It was always his dream to host The Tonight Show.
Who cares? It was still – I don't care if it was his dream. It was contractually promised to him.
Well, here's what he had to say about following his dream.
You know, I'm trying very hard to stay positive here, and I want to tell you something. This is honest. Hosting The Tonight Show has been the fulfillment of a lifelong dream for me. And I just want to say to the kids out there watching, you can do anything you want in life. Yeah. Yeah, unless Jay Leno wants to do it too.
Well, I think we should start a new segment called Guess Who Said It. I'm winging this, so this is my brand new segment that I'm making up all on the fly here. This is the Guess Who Said It late night edition, thanks to the New York Times. Guess who said this, and when and to whom? Quote, I am disappointed. I feel like a guy who has bought a car from somebody, painted it, fixed it up, and made it look nice, and then the guy comes back and says he promised to sell the car to his brother-in-law. Who said it, to whom, when, and why?
Jay Leno said it, but it was a while ago.
I didn't look at the link. I'm guessing it was Conan because he had a disastrous first year when he was in late night following Leno.
It was Jay Leno talking to Bill Carter in 1992 amid rumors that he was about to lose The Tonight Show to David Letterman. Very interesting how history does repeat itself sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, it's a shame that it all had to come to this.
Oh, it's not a shame. It's fun.
No, it's delicious. I love it.
It's a big deal.
Wow, what a segue.
I
guess you're trying to say it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, the segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or whether anybody should care about them. First up this week is American Idol, opening to an audience of 30 million viewers on Tuesday and 26.4 million viewers on Wednesday. So obviously kind of a dud. They're a little concerned about the show. Pants on the floor. The debut was up over last season, and day two was virtually identical to last year, which itself was larger than the year before. Idol remains the number one show in the country, and Michael, you might want to explain the whole pants on the floor thing.
Well, I mean, you know, everybody says, oh, Idol, it's tired, it's old, the judges are leaving. It's the number one show in the country. They've already got a breakout video from the second night with this guy performing this silly original song, Pants on the Floor. It's just a sort of silly YouTube-y type thing that networks love that gets a lot of attention for a show. It's back part of the pop cultural discussion, and American Idol's back, and it's a big deal because it's the number one show in the country. So, Karen, is it a big deal or a big whoop that Idol opens again at number one?
I think it's too premature to even be talking about this. Ask me again when Idol premieres and Simon Cowell's not on it.
That's in 2 years.
Yep, we'll talk about it then.
Okay. The next item is I'm wondering about TMZ. They were the first kind of really to run a story claiming that Conan was out and Jay is in at 11:35 and that Conan would leave the network. NBC denied it at the time. And of course, the basic elements of the story have proven true. Is this a big deal for TMZ or a big whoop?
You know, I said that this was a big deal when they called the Michael Jackson death. So now it's a big whoop only because they've already proven themselves. TMZ's always right.
Well, I say it's a big whoop because, frankly, the article was two sentences long and quoted unnamed sources, which is fine. You know, that's kind of the entertainment journalist way these days. But, you know, it was kind of vague about, well, he's going to receive some money to walk away. Well, no kidding. I mean, you know, yeah, okay, they had $30 million. Well, nobody really knows what that's going to be. I think it's a big whoop. Moving on, our next story is about Beyonce, who was caught performing for the son of Muammar Gaddafi, the Middle Eastern despot, for a reputed $2 million on New Year's Eve. And I guess she performed a private concert on the Caribbean island of St. Barts, and there are pictures in the Daily Swarm of this. Is this a big deal, Michael?
It is. It's a big deal, and it's pathetic. It really is. I mean, she's a multi-millionaire to cash in by performing for somebody who's literally has blood on their hands. I mean, Gaddafi is a brutal dictator, and his son is part of that, and it's disgusting. It really is. I wish it would harm her career more than it will.
Yeah, I agree. It's a big deal because it was such a bad choice. And is there, will she say no to anything? I mean, we could hire her for our birthday party.
He's a brutal, cruel dictator. You shouldn't shouldn't go to private events for brutal, cruel dictators. You know, if the head of North Korea says, hey, I got $2 billion, want to come party, you should say no. Especially when you're a multi-millionaire. She's rich as sin. So why she would agree to do this is beyond me.
Hold on, I'm just taking notes here. Don't go to dictators. Our next story. Glee's Matthew Morrison signs to Mercury Records and will have a solo album out this fall. Is this a big deal, Karen?
Wait, who?
Glee's Matthew Morrison.
Oh, no, I don't care.
Michael?
It's a big whoop because nobody buys albums anymore, but I'm happy for him.
He's so cute.
And he was great on Broadway in South Pacific. I liked him a lot in that. And the final item is mine, just trying to compare movies to video games. The film Avatar has grossed over $1 billion, and the video game Call of Duty Modern Warfare has grossed over $1 billion. And the result is that there will be an Avatar video games and there will be a Call of Duty film. So, Karen, is it a big deal or big whoop that video games are still keeping pace with film?
Oh, it's a huge deal. Huge deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. Absolutely. And I think you're going to be hearing more and more and more about video games. But, well, you know, time will see just how much more.
I wonder, has there anybody a video game engineered by a woman? I know a video game woman, Naomi Novik, who went on to create a great fantasy series of novels that I love about a dragon in the Napoleonic era. But I wonder if there's any major women involved in the video game industry.
Well, I know that's your way of trying to get us to our Inside Baseball segment, where we discuss the stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. But before we do, wanted to read a little listener email, which brings us back to Conan and Leno, from Jonathan Handel, who is not only a listener, but he's appeared on this show as he's of counsel at Troy Gould, and he has his blog, Digital Media Law, which we'll place a link to in the show notes. He sent in an email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com that says, various media outlets are predicting NBC will reach a deal with Conan O'Brien that would obligate NBC to pay in excess of $20 million to walk. Variety, for instance, says $30 to $40 million is the expected range. But what everybody's missing is two concepts from employment contract law that could ratchet down the numbers significantly, no matter what the final deal is. What Jonathan is referring to are two employment contract settlement clauses. One is for mitigation and one is offset. And if you go to his blog, you'll definitely see a little bit more about this. And mitigation is the concept that the terminated employee, in this case Conan, has an obligation to seek other employment. And if he fails to do so, the payments from NBC would stop because apparently Conan would not be paid all at once. Now, offset is the concept that whatever the employee earns at his or her new job, if any, would be offset against the settlement payments owed by the old employer. It's an interesting post. You should read it. We'll place a link to it in the show notes. But now, on to Inside Baseball, where we cover the stories that people in only Hollywood might care about. This week, with Kathryn Bigelow being nominated for a Directors Guild of America Award and having won the Critics' Choice Award for Best Director, there is a lot of talk that the filmmaker may be the first woman to win the Best Director Oscar in the history of the award show. Women in Hollywood and the film industry is a topic we discuss frequently here on Showbiz Sandbox, thanks in part to Karen. Joining us to discuss the issue today is Matthew Knott, a London-based writer and guest columnist at IndieWire, who wrote a post titled, "Is Kathryn Bigelow a Female Director?" Welcome, Matthew.
Hi.
Picking up where Matthew left off is Guy Lodge, a freelance writer and screenwriter based in London, who proves his dedication to the Oscars every year by getting up at 2 a.m. to watch the live broadcast in his part of the world. He is also a contributor to the In Contention blog, which covers the awards season quite well. He wrote a post recently on In Contention titled, "How Relevant is Kathryn Bigelow's Gender?" Thank you for joining us.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Finally, we are joined by Anne Hornaday, film critic for The Washington Post, whose article on women in film we discussed a few weeks ago on Showbiz Sandbox. Anne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I guess we should really kick off this conversation with Matthew. You wrote this post, "Is Kathryn Bigelow a Female Director?" What was your intention there in asking that question?
It was basically to raise some of the questions that have been coming up in various bits over the fact that Kathryn Bigelow has been winning a lot of awards this season, looks on course to possibly win the Oscar, and whether defining her or discussing her as a female director as opposed to just a film director was useful or necessary or consulting or to do.
And you actually say, yes, it is important to acknowledge her as a female director, despite the fact that her movie is somewhat masculine and that it covers war.
Yeah, the subject matter of her film is something that splits people in this particular issue. And I think it's because if you're discussing women in Hollywood, you're talking about the women behind the camera and women in front of the camera. And I guess if you're arguing from a position that you want to sort of improve the position of women in Hollywood and you're thinking about women on film, hers isn't a film that is at all concerned with any of those issues, which is why some people who are concerned with those issues would rather, you know, when a film like this, a director like that gets in the spotlight, would like it maybe if the subject matter of the film was sort of more directly concerned with women. But there's also, you know, people who think it's fantastic that she has been able to make the film that she wants, that she should have no pressure to make, you know, to concern herself with women in the films that she makes.
Well, and that's exactly, Guy, what you say, and I'm quoting you here. You say, "The Hurt Locker would be a stirring and distinctive a film had it been directed by someone with testicles, and though some will say otherwise, I think it would still have caught critics and awards voters' fancy. A great movie is a great movie is a great movie, after all."
I think that is absolutely the case, but at the same time, a great movie is a great movie doesn't always matter to awards voters. I think the Academy often, with their choices, instead of just looking at purely artistic kind of standards, they like to create a sort of larger narrative out of their winners. If you think back to, say, 2001, where Denzel Washington and Halle Berry both became the first sort of black actors to win both lead acting Oscars. And that became a bit of a cause that year, even though they were both very fine performances. And in a way, I think Kathryn Bigelow's gender, even though she's, I think, thoroughly deserving of awards on any terms, I think it could play into that, especially coming after what's been a very unusually strong year for female filmmakers across the board.
And do you find, obviously, we would all wish that we weren't having this discussion in the sense that half of the directors were women and women were involved in all levels of power in Hollywood. Do you find it depressing we're still talking about this? Or is it good that we're saying, hey, look, Betty Thomas is a big commercial director with something like Alvin and the Chipmunks. Nancy Myers is a big commercial director. And Kathryn Bigelow is gaining critical acclaim. And it's good to keep highlighting the accomplishments that are happening so that we can encourage more of it to go on in the future.
Well, I think it's not depressing at all to talk about Kathryn Bigelow, just because I think she has shattered so many. I just think what she has done in terms of, you know, it's exactly what everybody's been talking about in this discussion. She's really resisted, for lack of a better word, that female ghetto, you know, of rom-coms and relationship dramas and sort of those traditional ideas of what a quote-unquote women's film means. And she's just completely exploded that. So I just think it's – and you're right. I mean, it's been an extraordinary year for female directors of all stripes in different genres. So I think that's actually encouraging. What does – you know, I do – I'm kind of in a double – it's almost like cognitive dissonance, you know, when you're, you know, because it is true that a film is a film is a film, and that I'm very chary of talking about a female sensibility or even a feminist sensibility for that matter. I mean, you could argue that Lee Daniels, you know, made a feminist film this year, you know, with really strong, compelling female characters. So, you know, you want to kind of stay away from those notions. But I, you know, the more the better, you know, the more voices, the better, the more stories, the better. And where I was sort of coming down on my story earlier this year was the dearth of female, you know, the narrow range of female characters is almost of more concern to me, you know, in terms of just the stories that are getting told and the people that we're seeing depicted on screen.
And we should say that Lee Daniels is the director of Precious.
Correct.
Right. How much do you think it plays in that it's mostly men who run the studios and have the, you know, the biggest production companies? Where do you think that plays in?
I think it plays in a lot. And certainly when I was doing my story about female characters, when my reporting sort of bore out that that's an issue. Now, what's really going to be interesting, I mean, as interesting as the Kathryn Bigelow story this year is the Sandra Bullock story. Because with her having led in a movie that broke $200 million at the box office, The Blind Side, she is in a position of terrific power now in terms of getting movies made. And I think that is the story to watch, and that is the person to watch this year in terms of what she does. I mean, my sense is that her upcoming slate is mostly skewed toward romantic comedies. But I think, you know, her character in The Blind Side was a mother, and it was a maternal, you know, the storyline was about a woman adopting a child, which is, you know, you could argue a traditional female role. But it will be very. But it was also sort of an Erin Brockovich role in terms of just a really strong female character. And what I look forward to is seeing if maybe she might want to resurrect that Erin Brockovich, Clarice Starling character that we just haven't seen lately. And I would really be cheered by that.
Well, now, Matthew, you say in your post that many critics have expressed delight that Bigelow is receiving such acclaim for a film that is so atypical of the type of films women are usually allowed to direct. And that in an ideal world, her gender would be a fact barely worth mentioning. Do you think it's because the film is a war film that she's receiving this much attention?
I think it makes it more of a story that it is something that we don't expect a female director to make necessarily. And, you know, as we've said, the Oscars love a narrative. So I don't think you can rule that factor out, but I do think that the main, you know, it is mainly that it's just such a good film. And I think, again, you know, her gender plays in to the narrative of the awards season, and her subject matter plays into it. But, you know, there are some great stories surrounding actors and directors in films that just aren't good enough to win these awards. And hers is. So I think that is sort of, at the end of the day, that's the most important factor in why she's getting into it.
Well, and speaking of narrative, you have just last night, the Golden Globes, despite the fact that Kathryn Bigelow was the front runner going in, having won the Critics' Choice Award and being the kind of it girl, if you will, no pun intended, as far as directors go, for the awards season, James Cameron and Avatar won both the Best Film category and Best Director. What about this kind of battle between two people who used to be married, Kathryn Bigelow and James Cameron? I mean, that is somewhat of a narrative there in and of itself, that you know, an ex-husband, ex-wife are doing battle, don't you think, Guy?
Well, I'd like to add a part two to that. Would we even be talking about her if she wasn't A, married to Cameron once upon a time, and B, a beautiful woman?
Yeah.
Oh, I think, I'm sorry, this is Anne. I have to jump. Of course we would, because the film stands on its own. I mean, I really think that, and I think it's to her credit, to Catherine's credit, that she's the last person to claim any kind of special pleading, you know, on the basis of gender. You know, she's all steadfastly throughout her career. She's made pictures that do not, you know, she's just put her head down and honed her craft and made progressively better movies, you could argue. And this is the apotheosis of that. And I honestly think the gender piece and certainly the Cameron storyline are, I don't think they're really part of the story at all, actually.
Well, and Karen, thank you for saving my poorly asked question. Really what I wanted to ask was, do you think that Cameron winning the Golden Globe for Best Director and Avatar winning the award for Best Film, does that now change the awards landscape going into the Oscars and the DGA awards?
I don't think it's really moved the needle that much one way or the other, because I don't think The Hurt Locker was ever a Golden Globes type of movie, because they always go for slightly warmer, more romantic, more studio-based fare. And I think the moment, you know, Jeremy Renner didn't get a nomination at the Globes, I think you knew that they were nominating it more because they felt they had to than because it was something they really liked. I don't think the Academy is necessarily the same, inclined quite the same way. I think it's going to be the Guild Awards that are more telling there. And I think Catherine Bigelow is still very much in with a shot there, because I think people in the industry really do want her to succeed. And as much as, you know, the fact that she used to be married to James Cameron should be a kind of interesting trivia footnote to the whole race, I think it actually helps her chances in a way. It almost gives her a kind of underdog quality in the race. People want to see her. People want to see her win. I know I do.
You know, I have a question. Can I make a statement in the form of a question?
Sure, why not?
It's a sincere question, which is the fact that the Academy is made up mostly of actors, and that the Hurt Locker was such a showcase, not just for Renner's performance. It was a fantastic ensemble. I mean, it was really, in addition to just being beautifully directed, it was just such a wonderful platform for these performances. And then I'm wondering, too, like how sort of nervous actors are with Avatar in terms of just the implications for their profession that it raises. And I'm wondering if that will inform the voting at all.
That's actually a very good point, because, of course, that's the big news story these days is the technology in Avatar and whether actors are now superfluous. And of course,
and SAG makes up the biggest voting block for the Academy.
Well, and that's why, of course, there's been a historic prejudice against animated films, because actors feel like they're not on screen. And that's why only one animated film has ever been nominated for Best Picture. I wondered if someone could step in and talk about how this really is Catherine Bigelow's moment. Not in the sense that she's been overlooked for years, but she really has, as Anne says, progressed as a director. You know, I like Point Break and Near Dark, and they're fun movies, but she has been getting better. And this is her first film that really deserves to be up for Best Picture and Best Director. And it's good to be able to see someone get enough work and grow, man or woman. But it's not someone like, say, Jane Campion or Agnes Varda, where they were ignored for years making great films. But in fact, she's really flourished and getting the attention when she deserves it and has earned it. And that makes it all the more satisfying that she's at this point in her career.
I think in a way, Bigelow reminds me a bit of Danny Boyle at this point last year, in that she's a filmmaker who people have admired for a long time, but she's always done work that's slightly on the fringes and she's never done an obvious, you know, Academy Award contender before. Not that even The Hurt Locker is a terribly Academy-friendly film, but she's worked more she's played more with genre and with kind of action filmmaking, not unlike actually her ex-husband. And I think you said exactly right. This is the moment when everything is aligned for her in terms of her making a film with that kind of broad appeal. The fact that that's finally combined with a potential female directing nominee is, I'm not sure that's an opportunity the Academy really wants to miss.
Now, Matthew, you mentioned in your post that a lot of the subject matters of Catherine Bigelow's films, they don't really advance the role of women in film, or women in cinema, but that you hoped that in at least some of her acceptance speeches at these award shows that she would acknowledge the role of women in film and her gender. Why is that? Is it important?
I do want to say that, you know, she, as I, and I go on to say, she, I don't want to tell her what to do at all, and she can do, you know, she can say what she wants, obviously. I'm, you know, if there's a way without making it an issue, without sort of saying that her gender is the only reason she's up there, if there was a way of sort of celebrating that, that is something that I would personally like to see.
It's the best way for women directors to get ahead to act like men.
Boy, that's a good question. You mean act like them in terms of their behavior in the business, or act like them in terms of the kinds of movies they make?
In any way at all.
Hitting on assistants, treating people like dirt, and making action films.
And sleeping, yeah, right. And sleeping with the starlet. I don't know.
And
I mean,
throwing out with studio heads.
I mean, I think this past year is really instructive. If you look at Jane Campion, Lonnie Scherfig, Catherine, you look at young people, you know, like Drew Barrymore with her, and people like Diablo Cody and Karan Kusama. Do they act like men? I don't know. I mean, I just think to the degree that you act like a man by just behaving in a tough professional way, yeah, no, sure, of course. And I think they probably all have done that, to, you know, in their own ways in terms of just surviving. Andrea Arnold, another one coming down the pike with Fish Tank. I mean, there's so – it's really – I'm sorry. I'm being inarticulate. I guess the honest answer is I really don't know.
Well,
but
really,
do they have to make, like, tough guy movies? I mean, you don't see Whippet being nominated for anything.
Well, but it didn't deserve – I mean, it's like what we've been saying. I don't think Catherine's previous films would have been and should have been either. I mean, they were what they were. They were fabulous little genre pieces, and this is an art film. I mean, you know, and I think more than her gender, in a way, I think this is a testament to her artist, you know, her artistic background. I mean, I think you could just as much argue, should more artists be making film? I mean, she trained as a painter. She taught at CalArts. She was a serious conceptual artist and painter, and she brings all those values to bear. You know, and I think is just a visual text. You know, this is one of the most sophisticated films, you know, that we will have seen this past year. So, I mean, you could just as easily see it through that lens as a gender lens.
And yet it's a film, The Hurt Locker, that is, that very few people actually saw in theaters.
I just wanted to say that I think that the box office does also play into the narrative of it being, you know, I don't know when the last time a film was such a small box office has been such a contender for best picture, and that I think, as well as the gender or anything else, is why people might want to vote for it as a way of saying, you know, you need to see this film.
I also wanted to backtrack just to the question of whether women have to make particularly masculine films to get acknowledged this way, and the obvious answer is to point to The Piano and Lost in Translation, which were very delicate, you know, character-oriented feminine films. And so I think the obvious answer is no. But I'm also not entirely convinced that, you know, Catherine Bigelow's gender is entirely invisible in The Hurt Locker, because I think part of what makes it so striking is it is a very intimate war film, it shows military men in a very, very vulnerable light. And I think in a way it shows men as I think her female perspective is evident in that, and I don't think her gender is irrelevant to the film. I think it shapes the film. Any filmmaker brings their own identity to it.
Well, certainly the issue of women in film, be it in front of the camera, behind the camera, or in the executive suite, is one that will always be discussed, at least in our lifetime, and hopefully less and less so, because it will become a non-issue. Certainly, I thank you, and I'm going to speak for both Michael and Karen. I'd like to thank Guy Lodge from In Contention, which we will place a link to that in the show notes. And I believe your Twitter account is Guy Lodge, correct?
It is indeed, yeah. Simple as that.
And Matthew Knott from, well, a guest columnist from IndieWire.com. We'll place a link to his post in the show notes. Anne Hornaday is from The Washington Post, and we will place another link to her piece on women in film in the show notes as well. Well, thank you all for joining us to discuss the issue. We truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was a lot of fun. I'd like to thank the four men and two women who got together to discuss women in film.
Next up, women in journalism.
We'll have Bob Woodward and Edward R. Moreau and all to discuss women in journalism.
So now you're actually calling people up from the dead, I see.
Sure.
Okay, well.
As long as they're men.
As long as they're men.
As long as they're men.
Well, I mean, Karen, I mean, this is a topic that I know is close to your heart and
one... Yeah, I object to that because I brought up Nancy Myers and her commercial force and Sandra Bullock. I think it's of interest to all of us and anyone who's interested in good movies and seeing talent get ahead.
I stand duly corrected. You're right.
But I do disagree with the idea that we should someday it'll be a non-issue. We'll stop talking. You know what? Martin Scorsese is an Italian director. Spike Lee is a black director. Catherine Bigelow is a woman director. Whatever types of movies they make, it's just, you know, who you are and where you come from and your ethnicity and your gender matters and your sexuality. It all matters. There's no reason not to ever mention it or talk about it or ignore it. You know, the idea we'll all be colorblind and not notice gender or race or ethnicity is silly. It's like, no, it's perfectly good thing to celebrate and talk about and, you know, and have a starting off point as long as it doesn't hold anyone back.
Well, maybe at some point we can do a segment on the Italian-American directors working in Hollywood today.
I could give Marty a call.
Okay, you do that. In the meantime, I'm going to thank once again Guy Lodge from In Contention, Matthew Knott, who wrote a post for IndieWire and is a guest columnist there, and of course Anne Hornaday from The Washington Post. We'll place
and all our other guests.
And all of our other guests, Dylan Stableford as well from therap.com. We will place links to all of their work in our show notes, which can be found on our website, which is at showbizsandbox.com. Our website is also where you can find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter and Facebook. It's also where you can find information on how to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to this podcast in either the Zune Marketplace or the iTunes Store, and we encourage you to do so. That way you can listen to us week after week after week. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our episodes is by Management, or MGMT, the popular indie rock group. They can be found on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found, well, in New York, but he can also be found online at michaelgiltz.com, where links to all of his writings are posted. He's also on Twitter. Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen Woodward is on Twitter. Karen_Woodward is the username to look up. She can also be found, of course, in Los Angeles, but also online.
You want my address?
It's much better for stalking purposes, yes, if you could just. Karen Woodward online. .com is the website to look up for all of her work. I'm on Twitter. The username to look up is Sperling, or you can find some of my writing on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, when at least one of us will be coming to you from the Sundance Film Festival, play nice.